Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week, we bring you two stories by Kurt Vonnegut Jr., The Big Trip Up Yonder and To Be or Not to Be. Michael Crichton, writing in The New Republic, said, "He writes about the most excruciatingly painful things. His novels have attacked our deepest fears of automation and the bomb, our deepest political guilts, our fiercest hatreds and loves. No one else writes books on these subjects. They are inaccessible to normal novelists." And now, The Big Trip Up Yonder by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. Gramps Ford, his chin resting on his hands on the crook of his cane, was staring irascibly at the 5-foot television screen that dominated the room. On the screen, a news commentator was summarizing the day's happenings. Every 30 seconds or so, Gramps would jab the floor with his cane tip and shout, "Hell, we did that 100 years ago! Emerald and Lou, coming in from the balcony, where they had been seeking that 21 AD rarity, privacy, were obliged to take seats in the back row, behind Lou's father and mother, brother and sister-in-law, son and daughter-in-law, grandson and wife, granddaughter and husband, great-grandson and wife, nephew and wife, grandnephew and wife, great-grandniece and husband, great-grandnephew and wife, and of course, Gramps, who was in front of everybody. All, save Gramps, who was somewhat withered and bent, seemed by pre-anti-gerasone standards to be about the same age, somewhere in their late 20s or early 30s. Gramps looked older because he had already reached 70 when anti-gerasone was invented. He had not aged in the 102 years since. "Meanwhile," the commentator was saying, "Council Bluffs, Iowa was still threatened by stark tragedy, but 200 weary rescuers have refused to give up hope and continue to dig in an effort to save Elbert Hegedorn, 183, who has been wedged for 2 days in a..." "I wish he'd get something more cheerful," Emerald whispered to Lou.
"Silence!" cried Gramp. "Next one who shoots off his big bazoo while the TV's on is gonna find hisself cut off without a dollar."
His voice suddenly softened and sweetened.
"When they wave that checkered flag at the Indianapolis Speedway, and old Gramp gets ready for the big trip up yonder."
He sniffed sentimentally, while his heirs concentrated desperately on not making the slightest sound. For them, the poignancy of the prospective big trip had been dulled somewhat through having been mentioned by Gramps about once a day for 50 years.
"Dr. Brainerd Keyes Bullard," continued the commentator, "president of Wyandotte College, said in an address tonight that most of the world's ills can be traced to the fact that man's knowledge of himself has not kept pace with his knowledge of the physical world."
"Hell," snorted Gramps, "we said that 100 years ago.
"In Chicago tonight," the commentator went on, "a special celebration is taking place in the Chicago Lying-In Hospital. The guest of honor is Lowell W. Heitz, age 0. Heitz, born this morning, is the 25th million child to be born in the hospital."
The commentator faded and was replaced on the screen by the young Heitz, who squalled furiously.
"Hell," whispered Lou to Emerald, "we said that 100 years ago. "I heard that," shouted Gramps.
He snapped off the television set, and his petrified descendants stared silently at the screen.
"You there, boy!"
"I didn't mean anything by it, sir," said Lou,
age 103.
"Get me my will. You know where it is. You kids all know where it is. Fetch, boy."
Gramps snapped his gnarled fingers sharply. Lou nodded dully and found himself going down the hall, picking his way over bedding to Gramps' room, the only private room in the Ford apartment. The other rooms were the bathroom, the living room, and the wide, windowless hallway, which was originally intended to serve as a dining area and which had a kitchenette at one end. 6 mattresses and 4 sleeping bags were dispersed in the hallway and living room, and the daybed in the living room, accommodated the 11th couple, the favorites of the moment. On Gramps' bureau was his will, smeared, dog-eared, perforated, and blotched, with hundreds of additions, deletions, accusations, conditions, warnings, advice, and homely philosophy. The document was, Lou reflected, a 50-year diary, all jammed onto two sheets, a garbled, illegible log of day after day of strife. This day, Lou would be disinherited for the 11th time, and it would take him perhaps 6 months of impeccable behavior to regain the promise of a share in the estate, to say nothing of the daybed in the living room for M and himself.
"Boy!"
called Gramps. "Coming, sir." Lou hurried back into the living room and handed Gramps the will.
"Pen,"
said Gramps. He was instantly offered 11 pens, one from each couple.
"Not that leaky thing,"
he said, brushing Lou's pen aside.
"Ah, there's a nice one. Good boy, Willie."
He accepted Willie's pen. That was the tip they had all been waiting for. Willie, then, Lou's father, was the new favorite. Willie, who looked almost as young as Lou, though he was 142, did a poor job of concealing his pleasure. He glanced shyly at the daybed, which would become his, and from which Lou and Emerald would have to move back into the hall, back to the worst spot of all, by the bathroom door. Gramps missed none of the high drama he had authored, and he gave his own familiar role everything he had, frowning and running his finger along each line, as though he were seeing the will for the first time. He read aloud in a deep, portentous monotone, like a bass note on a cathedral organ.
"I, Harold D. Ford, residing in Building 257 of Alden Village, New York City, Connecticut, do hereby make, publish, and declare this to be my last will and testament, revoking any and all former wills and codicils by me at any time heretofore made."
He blew his nose importantly and went on, not missing a word, and repeating many for emphasis, repeating in particular his ever more elaborate specifications for a funeral. At the end of these specifications, Gramps was so choked with emotion that Lou thought he might have forgotten why he'd brought out the will in the first place. But Gramps heroically brought his powerful emotions under control, and after erasing for a full minute, began to write and speak at the same time. Lou could have spoken his lines for him. He had heard them so often.
"I have had many heartbreaks ere leaving this vale of tears for a better land,"
Gramps said and wrote.
"But the deepest hurt of all has been dealt me by..."
He looked around the group, trying to remember who the malefactor was. Everyone looked helpfully at Lou, who held up his hand resignedly. Gramps nodded, remembering, and completed the sentence.
"My great-grandson, Louis J. Ford."
"Grandson, sir," said Lou.
"Don't quibble. You're in deep enough now, young man,"
said Gramps, but he made the change. And from there he went without a misstep through the phrasing of the disinheritance, causes for which were disrespectfulness and quibbling. In the paragraph following, the paragraph that had belonged to everyone in the room at one time or another, Lou's name was scratched out, and Willie's substituted as heir to the apartment, and the biggest plum of all, the double bed in the private room.
"So,"
said Gramps, beaming. He erased the date at the foot of the will and substituted a new one, including the time of day.
"Well, time to watch the McGarvey family."
The McGarvey family was a television series that Gramps had been following since he was 60, or for a total of 112 years.
"I can't wait to see what's going to happen next," he said.
Lou detached himself from the group and lay down on his bed of pain by the bathroom door. Wishing Em would join him, he wondered where she was. He dozed for a few moments until he was disturbed by someone stepping over him to get into the bathroom. A moment later, he heard a faint gurgling sound, as though something were being poured down the wash basin drain. Suddenly, it entered his mind that Em had cracked up, that she was in there doing something drastic about Gramps.
"Em!"
he whispered through the panel. There was no reply, and Lou pressed against the door. The worn lock, whose bolt barely engaged its socket, held for a second, then let the door swing hard.
Morty! Gasped Lou.
Lou's great-grandnephew Mortimer, who had just married and brought his wife home to the Ford menage, looked at Lou with consternation and surprise. Morty kicked the door shut, but not before Lou had glimpsed what was in his hand. Gramps' enormous, economy-sized bottle of anti-gerasone, which had apparently been half-emptied, and which Morty was filling with tap water. A moment later, Morty came out, glared defiantly at Lou, and brushed past him wordlessly to rejoin his pretty bride. Shocked, Lou didn't know what to do. He couldn't let Gramps take the mouse-trapped anti-gerasone, but if he warned Gramps about it, Gramps would most certainly make life in the apartment, which was merely insufferable now, harrowing. Lou glanced into the living room and saw that the Fords, Emerald among them, were momentarily at rest, relishing the botches that the McGarveys had made of their lives. Stealthily, he went into the bathroom, locked the door as well as he could, and began to pour the contents of Gramps' bottle down the drain. He was going to refill it with full-strength anti-gerasone from the 22 smaller bottles on the shelf. The bottle contained a half gallon, and its neck was small, so it seemed to Lou that the emptying would take forever, and the most imperceptible smell of anti-gerasone, like Worcestershire sauce, now seemed to Lou, in his nervousness, to be pouring out into the rest of the apartment, through the keyhole and under the door. The bottle gurgled monotonously. Suddenly, up came the sound of music from the living room, and there were murmurs and the scraping of chair legs on the floor.
"Thus ends," said the television announcer, "the 29,121st chapter in the life of your neighbors and mine, the McGarvers."
Footsteps were coming down the hall. There was a knock on the bathroom door.
"Just a sec,"
Lou cheerily called out. Desperately, he shook the big bottle, trying to speed up the flow. His palm slipped on the wet glass, and the heavy bottle smashed on the tile floor. The door was pushed open, and Gramps, dumbfounded, stared at the incriminating mess. Lou felt a hideous prickling sensation on his scalp and the back of his neck. He grinned engagingly through his nausea, and for want of anything remotely resembling a thought, waited for Gramps to speak.
"Well, boy," said Gramps at last, "looks like you've got a little tidying up to do."
And that was all he said. He turned around, elbowed his way through the crowd, and locked himself in his bedroom. The Fords contemplated Lou in incredulous silence a moment longer and then hurried back to the living room as though some of his horrible guilt would taint them too if they looked too long. Morty stayed behind long enough to give Lou a quizzical, annoyed glance. Then he also went into the living room, leaving only Emerald standing in the doorway. Tears streamed over her cheeks.
"Oh, you poor lamb. Please don't look so awful. It was my fault. I put you up to this with my nagging about Gramps."
"No," said Lou, finding his voice. "Really, you didn't. Honest, Em, I was just..."
"You don't have to explain anything to me, hon. I'm on your side no matter what."
She kissed him on one cheek and whispered in his ear.
"It wouldn't have been murder, hon. It wouldn't have killed him. It wasn't such a terrible thing to do. It just would have fixed him so he'd be able to go any time God decided he wanted him."
"What's going to happen next, Em?" said Lou hollowly. "What's he going to do?"
Lou and Emerald stayed fearfully awake almost all night, waiting to see what Gramps was going to do. But not a sound came from the sacred bedroom. 2 hours before dawn, they finally dropped off to sleep. At 6 o'clock, they arose again, for it was time for their generation to eat breakfast in the kitchenette. No one spoke to them. They had 20 minutes in which to eat, but their reflexes were so dulled by the bad night that they had hardly swallowed 2 mouthfuls of egg-type processed seaweed before it was time to surrender their places to their son's generation. Then, as was the custom for whoever had been most recently disinherited, they began preparing Gramps' breakfast, which would presently be served to him in bed on a tray. They tried to be cheerful about it. The toughest part of the job was having to handle the honest-to-God eggs and bacon and oleomargarine on which Gramps spent so much of the income from his fortune.
"Well," said Emerald, "I'm not going to get all panicky until I'm sure there's something to be panicky about."
"Maybe he doesn't know what it was I busted," Lou said hopefully.
Probably thinks it was your watch crystal, offered Eddie, their son, who was toying apathetically with his buckwheat-type processed sawdust cakes.
Don't get sarcastic with your father, said Em, and don't talk with your mouthful either.
I'd like to see anybody take a mouthful of this stuff and not say something,
complained Eddie, who was 73. He glanced at the clock.
It's time to take Gramps' breakfast, you know.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Said Lou weakly. He shrugged.
Let's have the tray, Em.
We'll both go.
Walking slowly, smiling bravely, they found a large semicircle of long-faced Fords standing around the bedroom door. Em knocked.
Gramps, she called brightly. Breakfast is ready.
There was no reply, and she knocked again, harder.
The door swung open before her fist. In the middle of the room, the soft, deep, wide, canopied bed, the symbol of the sweet by-and-by to every Ford, was empty. A sense of death, as unfamiliar to the Fords as Zoroastrianism or the causes of the Sepoy Mutiny, stilled every voice, slowed every heart. Awed, their heirs began to search gingerly under the furniture and behind the drapes for all that was mortal of Gramps, father of the clan. But Gramps had left not his earthly husk, but a note, which Lou finally found on the dresser, under a paperweight which was a treasured souvenir from the World's Fair of 2000. Unsteadily, Lou read it out loud.
Somebody, who I have sheltered and protected and taught the best I know how all these years, last night turned on me like a mad dog and diluted my anti-gerasone, or tried to. I am no longer a young man. I can no longer bear the crushing burden of life as I once could. So after last night's bitter experience, I say goodbye. The cares of this world will soon drop away like a cloak of thorns, and I shall know peace. By the time you find this, I will be gone.
Gosh, said Willie brokenly.
He didn't even get to see how the 5,000-mile speedway race was going to come out.
Or the solar series, Eddie said with large, mournful eyes. Or whether Mrs. Garvey got her eyesight back, added Morty.
There's more, said Lou, and he began reading aloud again.
I, Harold D. Ford, etc., do hereby make, publish, and declare this to be my last will and testament, revoking any and all former wills and codicils by me at any time heretofore made.
No, cried Willie, not another one.
I do stipulate, read Lou, that all of my property of whatsoever kind and nature not be divided, but do devise and bequeath it to be held in common by my issue, without regard for generation, equally, share and share alike.
Issue? Said Emerald.
Lou included the multitude in a sweep of his hand.
It means we all own the whole damn shooting match.
Each eye turned instantly to the bed.
Share and share alike? Asked Morty.
Actually, said Willie, who was the oldest one present. It's just like the old system, where the oldest people head up things with their headquarters in here, and...
I like that, exclaimed Em. Lou owns as much of it as you do, and I say it ought to be for the oldest one who's still working. You can snooze around here all day, waiting for your pinch and chick, while poor Lou stumbles in here after work all tuckered out and...
How about letting somebody who's never had any privacy get a little crack at it? Eddie demanded hotly.
Hell, you old people had plenty of privacy back when you were kids. I was born and raised in the middle of that goddamn barracks in the hall.
How about...
Yeah? Morty challenged. Sure, you've had it pretty tough, and my heart bleeds for you. But try honeymooning in the hall for a real kick.
Silence!
Shouted Willie imperiously.
The next person who opens his mouth spends the next 6 months in the bathroom. Now clear out of my room. I want to think.
A vase shattered against the wall inches above his head. In the next moment, a free-for-all was underway, with each couple battling to eject every other couple from the room. Fighting coalitions formed and dissolved with the lightning changes of the tactical situation,
M and Lou were thrown into the hall, where they organized others in the same situation and stormed back into the room. After 2 hours of struggle, with nothing like a decision in sight, the cops broke in, followed by television cameramen from mobile units. For the next half hour, patrol wagons and ambulances hauled away Fords, and then the apartment was still and spacious. An hour later, films of the last stages of the riot were being televised to 500 million delighted viewers on the eastern seaboard. In the stillness of the three-room Ford apartment on the 76th floor of Building 257, the television set had been left on. Once more, the air was filled with the cries and grunts and crashes of the fray, coming harmlessly now from the loudspeaker. The battle also appeared on the screen of the television set in the police station, where the Fords and their captors watched with professional interest. M and Lou, in adjacent 4x4 cells, were stretched out peacefully on their cots.
M, called Lou through the partition. You got a wash basin all your own, too?
Sure. Wash basin, bed, light, the works. And we thought Gramps' room was something. How long has this been going on?
She held out her hand.
For the first time in 40 years, hon, I've got the shakes. Look at me.
Cross your fingers, said Lou. The lawyer's going to try to get us a year.
Gee, M said dreamily. I wonder what kind of wires you'd have to pull to get put away in solitary.
All right, pipe down, said the turnkey, or I'll toss the whole kit and caboodle of you right out. And first one who lets on to anybody outside how good jail is ain't never getting back in.
The prisoners instantly fell silent. The living room of the apartment darkened for a moment as the riot scenes faded on the television screen, and then the face of the announcer appeared like the sun coming from behind a cloud.
"And now, friends," he said, "I have a special message from the makers of Anti-Gerasone, a message for all you folks over 150. Are you hampered socially by wrinkles, by stiffness of joints and discoloration or loss of hair, all because these things came upon you before Anti-Gerasone was developed? Well, if you are, you need no longer suffer. Need no longer feel different and out of things. After years of research, medical science has now developed super anti-gerasone. In weeks, yes, weeks, you can look, feel, and act as young as your great-great-grandchildren. Wouldn't you pay $5,000 to be indistinguishable from everybody else? Well, you don't have to. Safe, tested, super anti-gerasone costs you only a few dollars a day. Right now, for your free trial carton, just put your name and address on a dollar postcard and mail it to Super, Box 500,000, Schenectady, New York. Have you got that? I'll repeat it. Super, Box 500,000.
Underlining the announcer's words was the scratching of Gramps' pen, the one Willie had given him the night before. He had come in a few minutes earlier from the Idle Hour Tavern, which commanded a view of Building 257 from across the square of asphalt known as the Alden Village Green. He had called a cleaning woman to come straighten the place up, then had hired the best lawyer in town to get his descendants a conviction, a genius who had never gotten a client less than a year and a day. Gramps had then moved the daybed before the television screen so that he could watch from a reclining position. It was something he'd dreamed of doing for years.
"Schenectady," murmured Gramps. "Got it."
His face had changed remarkably. His facial muscles seemed to have relaxed, revealing kindness and equanimity under what had been taut lines of bad temper. It was almost as though his trial package of super anti-gerasone had already arrived. When something amused him on television, he smiled easily, rather than barely managing to lengthen the thin line of his mouth a millimeter. Life was good. He could hardly wait to see what was going to happen next. And now, to be or not to be. Everything was perfectly swell. There were no prisons, no slums, no insane asylums, no cripples, no poverty, no wars. All diseases were conquered. So was old age. death, barring accidents, was an adventure for volunteers. The population of the United States was stabilizing at 40 million souls. One bright morning in the Chicago Lying-in Hospital, a man named Edward K. Wheeling, Jr. waited for his wife to give birth. He was the only man waiting. Not many people were born a day anymore. Wheeling was 56, a mere stripling in a population whose average age was 129. X-rays had revealed that his wife was going to have triplets. The children would be his first. Young Wheeling was hunched in his chair, his head in his hands. He was so rumpled, so still and colorless as to be virtually invisible. His camouflage was perfect, since the waiting room had a disorderly and demoralizing air, too. Chairs and ashtrays had been moved away from the walls. The floor was paved with spattered drop cloths. The room was being redecorated. It was being redecorated as a memorial to a man who had volunteered to die. A sardonic old man, about 200 years old, sat on a stepladder, painting a mural he did not like. Back in the day when people aged visibly, his age would have been guessed at 35 or so. Aging had touched him that much before the cure for aging was found. The mural he was working on depicted a very neat garden. Men and women in white, doctors and nurses, toiled the soil, planted seedlings, sprayed bugs, spread fertilizer. Men and women in purple uniforms pulled up weeds, cut down plants that were old and sickly, raked leaves, carried refuse to trash burners. Never, 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 not even in medieval Holland nor old Japan, had a garden been more formal, been better tended. Every plant had all the loam, light, water, air, and nourishment it could use. A hospital orderly came down the hall, singing under his breath a popular song. "If you don't like my kisses, honey, here's what I do. I'll go see a girl in purple, kiss this sad world, toodle-doo. If you don't want my lovin', why should I take up all this space? I'll get off this old planet, let some sweet baby have my place." The orderly looked at the mural and the muralist. "Looks so real," he said. "I can practically imagine I'm standing in the middle of it." "What makes you think you're not in it?" said the painter. He gave a satiric smile. "It's called the Happy Garden of Life, you know." "That's good of Dr. Heitz," said the orderly. He referred to one of the male figures in white, whose head was a portrait of Dr. Benjamin Heitz, the hospital's chief obstetrician. Heitz was a blindingly handsome man. "Lots of faces still to fill in," said the orderly. He meant that the faces of many of the figures in the mural were still blank. All blanks were to be filled with portraits of important people on either side of the hospital staff, or from the Chicago office of the Federal Bureau of Termination. "Must be nice to make pictures that look like something," said the orderly. The painter's face curdled with scorn. "You think I'm proud of this daub?" he said. "You think this is my idea of what life really looks like?" "Well, what's your idea of what life looks like?" said the orderly. The painter gestured at a foul drop cloth. "Where's a good picture of it?" he said. "Frame that, and you'll have a picture a damn sight more honest than this one." "You're a gloomy old duck, aren't you?" said the orderly. "Is that a crime?" said the painter. The orderly shrugged. "If you don't like it here, Grandpa," he said. And he finished the thought with the trick telephone number that people who didn't want to live anymore were supposed to call. The zero in the telephone number he pronounced not. The number was 2BR02B. It was the telephone number of an institution whose fanciful sobriquets included Automate, Birdland, Canary, Catbox, D-Louser, Easy Go, Goodbye Mother, Happy Hooligan, Kiss Me Quick, Lucky Pierre, Sheep Dip, Warring Blender, Weep No More, and Why Worry? To be or not to be was the telephone number of the municipal gas chambers of the Federal Bureau of Termination. The painter thumbed his nose at the orderly. "When I decide it's time to go," he said, "it won't be in the sheep dip." "A do-it-yourselfer, eh?" said the orderly.
Messy business, Grandpa. Why don't you have a little consideration for the people who have to clean up after you?
The painter expressed with an obscenity his lack of concern for the tribulations of his survivors.
The world could do with a good deal more mess, if you ask me, he said.
The orderly laughed and moved on. Wheeling, the waiting father mumbled something without raising his head, and then he fell silent again. A coarse, formidable woman strode into the waiting room on spike heels. Her shoes, stockings, trench coat, bag, and overseas cap were all purple. The purple the painter called the color of grapes on Judgment Day. The medallion on her purple musette bag was the seal of the Service Division of the Federal Bureau of Termination, an eagle perched on a turnstile. The woman had a lot of facial hair, an unmistakable mustache, in fact. A curious thing about gas chamber hostesses was that no matter how lovely and feminine they were when recruited, they all sprouted mustaches within 5 years or so.
"Is this where I'm supposed to come?"
she asked to the painter.
"A lot would depend on what your business was," he said. "You aren't about to have a baby, are you?"
"They told me I was supposed to pose for some picture," she said. "My name is Leora Duncan,"
she waited.
"And you dunk people?"
he said.
"What?"
she said.
"Skip it," he said.
"That sure is a beautiful picture," she said. "Looks just like heaven or something."
"Or something,"
said the painter. He took a list of names from his smock pocket.
"Duncan, Duncan, Duncan,"
he said, scanning the list.
"Yes, here you are. You're entitled to be immortalized. See any faceless body here you'd like to stick your head on? We've got a few choice ones left."
She studied the mural bleakly.
"Gee," said she, "they're all the same to me. I don't know anything about art."
"A body's a body, eh?" he said. "All righty. As a master of fine art, I recommend this body here."
He indicated a faceless figure of a woman who was carrying dried stalks to a trash burner.
"Well," said Leora Duncan, "that's more the disposal people, isn't it? I mean, I'm in service. I don't do any disposing."
The painter clapped his hands in mock delight.
"You say you don't know anything about art, and then you prove in the next breath that you know more about it than I do. Of course, the sheave carrier is wrong for a hostess. A snipper, a pruner, that's more your line."
He pointed to a figure in purple who was sawing a dead branch from an apple tree.
"How about her?" he said. "You like her at all?"
"Gosh," she said, and she blushed and became humble. That puts me right next to Dr. Heights."
"That upsets you?" he said.
"Good gravy, no," she said. It's such an honor."
"Ah, you admire him, eh?" he said.
"Who doesn't admire him?"
she said, worshipping the portrait of Heights. It was the portrait of a tanned, white-haired, omnipotent Zeus, 240 years old.
"Who doesn't admire him?" she said again. "He was responsible for setting up the very first gas chamber in Chicago."
"Nothing would please me more," said the painter, "than to put you next to him for all time. Sawing off a limb, that strikes you as appropriate?"
"Well, that is kind of what I do," she said.
She was demure about what she did. What she did was make people comfortable while she killed them. And while Leora Duncan was posing for her portrait, into the waiting room bounded Dr. Heights himself. He was 7 feet tall, and he boomed with importance, accomplishments, and the joy of living.
"Well, Miss Duncan, Miss Duncan," he said, and he made a joke. "What are you doing here?" he said. "This isn't where the people leave. This is where they come in."
"We're going to be in the same picture together," she said shyly.
"Good," said Dr. Heights heartily. "And say, isn't that some picture?"
"I sure am honored to be in it with you," she said.
"Let me tell you," he said, "I'm honored to be in it with you. Without women like you, this wonderful world we've got wouldn't be possible."
He saluted her and moved toward the door that led to the delivery rooms.
"Guess what was just born?" he said.
I can't, she said.
Triplets, he said.
Triplets, she said.
She was exclaiming over the legal implications of triplets. The law said that no newborn child could survive unless the parents of the child could find someone who would volunteer to die. Triplets, if they were all to live, called for 3 volunteers.
Do the parents have the 3 volunteers?
Said Leora Duncan.
Well, last I heard, said Dr. Heitz, they had 1 and were trying to scrape another 2 up.
I don't think they made it, she said. Nobody made 3 appointments with us. Nothing but singles going through today, unless somebody called in after I left. What's the name?
Wheeling,
said the waiting father, sitting up, red-eyed and frowsy.
Edward K. Wheeling, Jr. is the name of the happy father-to-be.
He raised his right hand, looked at a spot on the wall, gave a hoarsely wretched chuckle.
Present,
he said.
Oh, Mr. Wheeling, said Dr. Heitz, I didn't see you there.
The invisible man, said Wheeling.
They just phoned me that your triplets have been born, said Dr. Heitz. They're all fine, and so is the mother. I'm on my way to see them now.
Hooray, said Wheeling emptily.
You don't sound very happy, said Dr. Heitz.
What man in my shoes wouldn't be happy, said Wheeling. He gestured with his hands to symbolize carefree simplicity.
All I have to do is pick out which of the triplets is going to live, then deliver my maternal grandfather to the happy hooligan and come back here with a receipt.
Dr. Heitz became rather severe with Wheeling, towering over him.
You don't believe in population control, Mr. Wheeling, he said.
I think it's perfectly keen, said Wheeling tautly.
Would you like to go back to the good old days when the population of the Earth was 20 billion, about to become 40 billion, then 80 billion, then 160 billion? Do you know what a druplet is, Mr. Wheeling?
Said Heitz.
Nope, said Wheeling sulkily. A druplet, Mr. Wheeling, is one of the little knobs, one of the little pulpy grains of a blackberry, said Dr. Heitz. Without population control, human beings would now be packed on this surface of this old planet like druplets on a blackberry. Think of it!
Wheeling continued to stare at the same spot on the wall.
In 2,000 years, said Dr. Heitz, before scientists stepped in and laid down the law, there wasn't even enough drinking water to go around, and nothing to eat but seaweed. And still people insisted on their right to reproduce like jackrabbits, and their right, if possible, to live forever.
I want those kids, said Wheeling quietly. I want all 3 of them.
Of course you do, said Dr. Heitz. That's only human.
I don't want my grandfather to die either, said Wheeling.
Nobody's really happy about taking a close relative to the cat box,
said Dr. Heitz gently, sympathetically.
I wish people wouldn't call it that, said Leora Duncan.
What? Said Dr. Heitz.
I wish people wouldn't call it the cat box and things like that, she said. It gives people the wrong impression.
You're absolutely right, said Dr. Heitz. Forgive me.
He corrected himself, gave the municipal gas chambers their official title, a title no one ever used in conversation.
I should have said Ethical Suicide Studios, he said.
Oh, that sounds so much better, said Leora Duncan.
This child of yours, whichever one you decide to keep, Mr. Wheeling, said Dr. Heitz, he or she is going to live on a happy, roomy, clean, rich planet, thanks to population control, in a garden like that mural there.
He shook his head.
2 centuries ago, when I was a young man, it was a hell that nobody thought could last another 20 years. Now, centuries of peace and plenty stretch before us as far as the imagination cares to travel.
He smiled luminously. The smile faded as he saw that Dr. Wheeling had just drawn a revolver. Wheeling shot Dr. Heitz dead.
There's room for 1 more, a great big one, he said.
And then he shot Leora Duncan.
It's only death,
he said to her as she fell.
There, room for two.
And then he shot himself, making room for all three of his children. Nobody came running. Nobody seemingly heard the shots. The painter sat on the top of his stepladder, looking down reflectively on the sorry scene. The painter pondered the mournful puzzle of life, demanding to be born and once born, demanding to be fruitful, to multiply, to live as long as possible, to do all that on a very small planet that would have to last forever. All the answers that the painter could think of were grim, even grimmer, surely, than the cat box, a happy hooligan, and easy go. He thought of war. He thought of plague. He thought of starvation. He knew that he would never paint again. He let his paintbrush fall to the drop cloths below. And then he decided he had had about enough of life and the happy garden of life, too, and he came slowly down from the ladder. He took Wheeling's pistol, really intending to shoot himself, but he didn't have the nerve. And then he saw the telephone booth in the corner of the room. He went to it, dialed the well-remembered number, 2BR, not 2B. "Federal Bureau of Termination," said the very warm voice of a hostess.
"How soon could I get an appointment?"
he asked, speaking very carefully.
"We could probably fit you in late this afternoon, sir," she said. "It might even be earlier if we get a cancellation."
"All right," said the painter. "Fit me in, if you please."
And he gave her his name, spelling it out.
"Thank you, sir," said the hostess. "Your city thanks you. Your country thanks you. Your planet thanks you. But the deepest thanks of all is from future generations."
It seems we have a little extra time, so I'd like to do one more short one, called Harrison Bergeron. The year was 2081, and everybody was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and the law. They were equal every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anybody else. All this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th Amendments to the Constitution and to the unceasing vigilance of agents of the United States Handicapper General. Some things about living still weren't quite right, though. April, for instance, still drove people crazy by not being springtime, and it was in that clammy month that the H.G. men took George and Hazel Bergeron's 14-year-old son, Harrison, away. It was tragic, all right, but George and Hazel didn't think about it very hard. Hazel had a perfectly average intelligence, which meant she couldn't think about anything except in short bursts, and George, while his intelligence was way above normal, had a little mental handicap radio in his ear. He was required by law to wear it at all times. It was tuned to a government transmitter. Every 20 seconds or so, the transmitter would send out some sharp noise to keep people like George from taking unfair advantage of their brains. George and Hazel were watching television. There were tears on Hazel's cheeks, but she'd forgotten for the moment what they were about. On the television screen were ballerinas. A buzzer sounded in George's head. His thoughts fled in panic, like bandits from a burglar alarm.
"That was a real pretty dance, that dance they just did," said Hazel.
"Huh?"
said George.
"That dance. It was nice," said Hazel.
"Yep,"
said George. He tried to think a little about the ballerinas. They weren't really very good, no better than anybody else would have been anyway. They were burdened with sash weights and bags of birdshot, and their faces were masked so that no one, seeing a free and graceful gesture or a pretty face, would feel like something the cat drug in. George was toying with the vague notion that maybe dancers shouldn't be handicapped, but he didn't get very far with it before another noise in his ear radio scattered his thoughts. George winced. So did two out of the eight ballerinas. Hazel saw him wince. Having no mental handicap herself, she had asked George what the latest sound had been.
"It sounded like somebody hitting a milk bottle with a ball-peen hammer," said George.
"I'd think it would be real interesting hearing all the different sounds," said Hazel, a little envious. "All the things they think up."
earn, said George.
Only, if I was Handicapper General, you know what I'd do? Said Hazel. Hazel, as a matter of fact, bore a strong resemblance to the Handicapper General, a woman named Diana Moon Glampers. If I was Diana Moon Glampers, said Hazel, I'd have chimes on Sunday, just chimes, kind of in honor of religion.
Well, I could think if it was just chimes, said George.
Well, maybe make 'em real loud, said Hazel. I think I'd make a good Handicapper General.
Good as anybody else, said George.
Who knows better than I do what normal is, said Hazel.
Right,
said George. He began to think glimmeringly about his abnormal son, who was now in jail, about Harrison, but a 21-gun salute in his head stopped that. Boy, said Hazel, that was a doozy, wasn't it? It was such a doozy that George was white and trembling, and tears stood on the rim of his red eyes. Two of the ballerinas who had collapsed to the studio floor were holding their temples.
All of a sudden you look so tired, said Hazel. Why don't you stretch out on the sofa, so's you can rest your handicap bag on the pillows, honey bunch?
She was referring to the 47 pounds of birdshot in a canvas bag, which was padlocked around George's neck.
Go on and rest the bag for a little while, she said. I don't care if you're not equal to me for a while.
George weighed the bag with his hands.
I don't mind, he said. I don't notice it any more. She's part of me.
You've been so tired lately, kind of worn out, said Hazel. If there was just some way we could make a little hole in the bottom of the bag and just take out a few of them lead balls, just a few.
2 years in prison and $2,000 fine for every ball I took out, said George. I don't call that a bargain.
If you could just take a few out when you come home from work, said Hazel. I mean, you don't compete with anybody around here. You just sit around.
If I tried to get away with it, said George, then other people'd get away with it, and pretty soon we'd be right back in the Dark Ages again, with everybody competing against everybody else. You wouldn't like that, would you?
I'd hate it, said Hazel.
Well, there you are, said George. The minute people start cheating on laws, what do you think happens to society?
If Hazel hadn't been able to come up with an answer to this question, George couldn't have supplied one. A siren was going off in his head.
I reckon it'd all fall apart, said Hazel.
What would? Said George blankly.
Society, said Hazel uncertainly. Wasn't that what you just said?
Who knows, said George.
The television program was suddenly interrupted for a news bulletin. It wasn't clear at first as to what the bulletin was about, since the announcer, like all announcers, had a serious speech impediment. For about half a minute, and in a state of high excitement, the announcer tried to say,
Ladies,
He finally gave up, handing the bulletin to a ballerina to read.
That's all right, Hazel said of the announcer. He tried. That's the big thing. He tried to do the best he could with what God gave him. He should get a nice raise for trying so hard.
Ladies and gentlemen, said the ballerina, reading the bulletin. She must have been extraordinarily beautiful because the mask she wore was hideous, and it was easy to see that she was the strongest and most graceful of all the dancers, for her handicap bags were as big as those worn by 200-pound men. And she had to apologize at once for her voice, which was a very unfair voice for a woman to use. Her voice was a warm, luminous, timeless melody.
"Excuse me," she said, and she began again, making her voice absolutely uncompetitive. "Harrison Bergeron, age 14, she said in a grackle squawk, "has just escaped from jail where he was held on suspicion of plotting to overthrow the government. He is a genius and an athlete, is under-handicapped, and should be regarded as extremely dangerous."
A police photograph of Harrison Bergeron was flashed on the screen, upside down, then sideways, upside down again, then right side up. The picture showed a full length of Harrison against a background calibrated in feet and inches. He was exactly 7 feet tall. The rest of Harrison's appearance was Halloween and hardware.
Nobody had ever borne heavier handicaps. He had outgrown hindrances faster than the HG men could think them up. Instead of a little ear radio for a metal handicap, he wore a tremendous pair of earphones and spectacles with thick, wavy lenses. The spectacles were intended to make him not only half-blind, but to give him whanging headaches besides. Scrap metal was hung all over him. Ordinarily, there was a certain symmetry, a military neatness to the handicaps issued to strong people, but Harrison looked like a walking junkyard. In the race of life, Harrison carried 300 pounds. And to offset his good looks, the HG men required that he wear at all times a red rubber ball for a nose, keep his eyebrows shaved off, and cover his even white teeth with black caps at snaggletooth random.
"If you see this boy," said the ballerina, "do not, I repeat, do not try to reason with him."
There was the shriek of a door being torn from its hinges. Screams and barking cries of consternation came from the television set. The photograph of Harris Bergeron on the screen jumped again and again, as though dancing to the tune of an earthquake. George Bergeron correctly identified the earthquake, and well he might have, for many was the time his own home had danced to the same crashing tune.
"My God," said George, "that must be Harrison."
The realization was blasted from his mind instantly by the sound of an automobile collision in his head. When George could open his eyes again, the photograph of Harrison was gone. A living, breathing Harrison filled the screen. Clanking, clownish, and huge, Harrison stood in the center of the studio. The knob of the uprooted studio door was still in his hand. Ballerinas, technicians, musicians, and announcers cowered on their knees before him, expecting to die.
"I am the Emperor," cried Harrison. "Do you hear me? I am the Emperor. Everybody must do what I say at once."
He stomped his foot, and the studio shook.
"Even as I stand here," he bellowed, "crippled, hobbled, sickened, I am a greater ruler than any man who ever lived. Now watch me become what I can become."
Harrison tore the straps of his handicap harness like wet tissue paper, tore straps guaranteed to support 5,000 pounds. Harrison's scrap iron handicaps crashed to the floor. Harrison thrust his thumbs under the bar of the padlock that secured his head harness. The bar snapped like celery. Harrison smashed his headphones and spectacles against the wall. He flung away his rubber ball nose, revealing a man that would have awed Thor, the god of thunder.
"I shall now select my empress," he said,
looking down at the cowering people.
"Let the first woman who dares rise to her feet claim her mate and her throne."
A moment passed, and then a ballerina arose, swaying like a willow. Harrison plucked the mental handicap from her ear, snapped off her physical handicaps with marvelous delicacy, last of all, removed her mask. She was blindingly beautiful.
"Now," Harrison said, taking her hand, "shall we show the people the meaning of the word dance?"
"Music,"
he commanded. The musicians scrambled back into their chairs, and Harrison stripped them of their handicaps too.
"Play your best," he told them, "and I'll make you barons and dukes and earls."
The music began. It was normal at first, cheap, silly, false. But Harrison snatched two musicians from their chairs, waved them like batons as he sang the music he wanted it played. He slammed them back into their chairs. The music began again and was much improved. Harrison and his empress merely listened to the music for a while, listened gravely, as though synchronizing their heartbeats with it. They shifted their weights to their toes. Harrison placed his big hands on the girl's tiny waist, letting her sense the weightlessness that would soon be hers. And then, in an explosion of joy and grace, into the air they sprang. Not only were the laws of the land abandoned, but the law of gravity and the laws of motion as well. They reeled and whirled, swiveled, flounced, capered, camboled, and spun. They leapt like deer on the moon. The studio ceiling was 30 feet high, but each leap brought the dancers nearer to it. It became their obvious intention to kiss the ceiling. They kissed it. And then, neutraling gravity with love and pure will, they remained suspended in air, inches below the ceiling, and they kissed each other for a long, long time. It was then that Diana Moon Clamper, the handicapper general, came into the studio with a double-barreled 10-gauge shotgun. She fired twice, and the Emperor and the Empress were dead before they hit the floor. Diana Moon Clamper loaded the gun again. She aimed it at the musicians and told them they had 10 seconds to get their handicaps back on. It was then that the Bergeron's television tube burned out. Hazel turned to comment about the blackout to George, but George had gone out into the kitchen for a can of beer. George came back in with the beer, paused while a handicap signal shook him up, and then he sat down again.
"You been crying?" he said to Hazel.
"Yep," she said.
"Well, what about?"
"I forget," she said. "Something really sad on television."
"What was it?" he said.
"It's all kind of mixed up in my mind," said Hazel.
"Forget sad things," said George.
"I always do," said Hazel.
"That's my girl," said George.
He winced. There was the sound of a riveting gun in his head.
"Gee, I could tell that one was a doozy," said Hazel. "You can say that again," said George.
"Gee," said Hazel, "I could tell that one was a doozy."
And there's our stories for this evening. I hope you enjoyed The Big Trip Up Yonder, To Be or Not to Be, and Harrison Bergeron by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.